It's September 11th, 1985. It's pouring in St. John's, Newfoundland. On one side of town, the Canadian team is covered head to toe in mud and sweat, embracing the ugly weather to its fullest. On the other side of town, the Honduran team has chosen to take shelter and practice indoors. In 3 days, these countries will play in what is the most important soccer match in Canadian history. Canada has yet to lose in the final round of CONCACAF qualifying and just needs a win or draw to go to their first ever World Cup. Now, you may be asking, why wouldn't they play such an important match in Toronto or Vancouver or even Ottawa? Why the hell are they in St. John's, Newfoundland? Well, 3 weeks prior, Honduras had scheduled their home game against Canada during the hottest part of the day. The 40,000-seat stadium in Honduras' capital, Tegucigalpa, was filled 6 hours prior to the game. The atmosphere was so hostile and so intense that Canada required a police escort to get to and from the stadium safely.
Now a chance for Canada. Randy Reagan chipping it in. First time, left foot shot, and it did! Beautiful opportunity seized! Just as we were wondering what Tony Waiters would do, there we have the win.
To the surprise of many, Canada was able to squeak out a 1-0 win. Now, it was the Hondurans' turn to travel, and St. John's represented Canada's retaliation. Not only was the cold climate advantageous to Canada, but with 4,800 kilometers of traveling required, St. John's was further away from Honduras than any other Canadian city. It had taken the Hondurans 2 straight days of traveling to make it down, and Canadian head coach Tony Waiters didn't try to hide his motivations.
Works against them, then we won't be too unhappy about that. But I really think that soccer teams have got to take into consideration all conditions and get on with the job.
This was a giant chance for Canada to put itself on the map as an ascending soccer nation. But in order to understand Canada's soccer journey, it's important to explain that the country's history with the game was richer and more complicated than the nation's attitude suggested. Let me explain. A 100 years prior in 1885, a collection of players from all over Western Ontario went down to New Jersey to play against teams representing the American Football Association. The word soccer hadn't been invented yet. The Canadians went down and defeated the Americans in what is considered the first international game between the two countries. So, Canada kept traveling. And 3 years after that 1885 win over the U.S., they would go to Great Britain to play 23 matches against some of the world's greatest clubs at the time. Comprised mainly of dentists, professors, journalists, and doctors, the Canadians earned rave reviews for their performances on the U.K. tour, prompting English newspaper Sporting Life to write, "With their performances, the Canadians have made themselves a deservedly high name as all-around exponents of football." Canada had beaten Premier League regulars like Sunderland FC, former and future Scottish League champions Hearts, and they had even delivered a 2-0 win over a little club called Newton Heath. Plot twist, Newton Heath would eventually become to be known as Manchester United. Canada even won an Olympic gold medal in soccer at the 1904 Olympics in St. Louis, when a club of players from Cambridge, Ontario, beat the U.S. in what was admittedly only a 3-team tournament at the time. Canadian soccer historian Colin Jost said that by the early 20th century, soccer ranked with hockey as Canada's national game of that era. But clearly, Canada's place in the early onsets of soccer history was more prosperous than we've been led to believe. So here's the question. How did the game fall so far off a cliff in this country? But before I answer this question, a little more history. Most of Canada's players went to fight in France during World War I. Some of them never came home, and those that did never played soccer again. As immigrants from all over Europe arrived in the 20th century, soccer became considered a sport for the outsiders. And consequently, anti-Canadian. All of a sudden, soccer was on the back burner in the country, and Canada wouldn't join FIFA World Cup qualifying until 1957, 27 years after the first World Cup took place. Beginning in 1940 through the 1960s, Canada had been establishing leagues all over the country. In 1961, the league that received the most backing was the concisely named Eastern Canada Professional Soccer League, also known as the ECPSL, which nobody called it.
George, I guess the headline news is the formation of the Eastern Canada Professional League.
Right, Gordon, and it's big news. As a matter of fact, it's the biggest news since I have been connected with soccer in Canada for the last 11 years.
This is league co-founder George Gross laying out the league's top four priorities to CBC reporter Gordon Howard.
This professional soccer league has four major aims. One is to give the game permanence in Canada and keep it in Canadian hands. Two, make it the summer sport in Canada. Three, bring it up to the same level as hockey and football in Canada. And four, play the game as it is being played in 92 other countries of the world, that is, one game per week per city.
Featuring six teams from Toronto, Montreal, Buffalo, and Hamilton, the summer-only league was able to attract a number of high-profile international players, including England's legendary Stanley Matthews, who'd won the first-ever European Player of the Year award just 5 years prior.
Probably the most brilliant pocket right wing ever, Stan Matthews. Like most great players, Stan's shy, so we let his feet speak for him.
Yet, the league never really took off domestically. But when the 1966 World Cup attracted over a million North American viewers, Toronto, Montreal, Calgary, Edmonton, and Vancouver were all invited to the newly formed and heavily funded North American Soccer League, or NASL, which was basically the MLS before the MLS.
Soccer Sounders style.
Playing the game to win. That's the name of the game we play.
Our style isn't a ballet with a ball. It's 90 minutes flat out.
Red and white, black and blue. Oh, the Sounders coming at you.
Soccer finally comes of age in the USA.
Oh, the Sounders playing it.
Did this commercial really work in attracting a soccer audience? It did, and it also attracted genuine soccer immortals to come over and play as well.
His real name is Edson Arantes do Nascimento. To millions of soccer fans, he is known as Pelé, number 10, the most celebrated player in the history of the game.
One of the fantastic goals of the year by the great Johan Cruyff.
George Best, all by himself. 4-3, 0-4 to Eusebio.
If you're not familiar with the names you just heard, think about it this way. Imagine how mind-blowing it would be if you found out Gretzky, Lemieux, Messier, and Bork had decided to finish their careers playing in a newly formed British Hockey League. But even that level of star wouldn't be enough for the NASL. By the end of the 1970s, it was bleeding money and even losing in viewership to the newly formed Major Indoor Soccer League. Yes, the Indoor Soccer League. Owners were withdrawing their cash, convinced that the 1966 World Cup was just lightning in a bottle. By the early 80s, the NASL was basically toast, and in 1984, it officially folded. The decline of the NASL prompted the formation of the Canadian Professional Soccer League in 1983. Unfortunately, that league lasted just 73 days. Let's pause the podcast for a second and do a quick league roll call. The Eastern Canadian Professional Soccer League gets ruined by the rise of the NASL. The NASL somehow loses in popularity to indoor soccer, and when the Canadian Professional Soccer League follows it up, it goes extinct within 3 months. Okay, back to the podcast. This brings us all to 1985. Most Canadians had been playing in the NASL or the Canadian Professional Soccer League, and the folding of both had left some without regular outdoor soccer. Because of this, like the players who traveled to England 100 years before, some Canadian players were still having to work second jobs. George Pagos, who scored that lone goal in Honduras, was reading water meters for the city of Victoria as a side job to pay for his soccer career. It was simply a different time.
So back in 1986, some kids listening to this might feel weird in the knowledge that not everything was available all the time and on demand.
That's the voice of Sid Sexero, formerly the host of Canada's most popular daytime sports show, Tim and Sid. And now a host of Rogers Breakfast Television, Sid has been as big an advocate for soccer in this country as any national media member. As a Canada soccer supporter his whole life, Sid remembers what following the national team was like in the 80s.
Soccer in the 80s and 90s was interesting because there wasn't a lot of it, but what you knew of it, you got through your parents, through the newspapers occasionally, through, you know, the few games that were on television, because most of my buddies were either Italian, Portuguese, so everyone's kind of in the loop, or your barber was one of the two. And then at the barber, it would open up this new database of information. I remember going to my barber was Italian when I was younger. His name was Aldo. He had a full tournament grid of the 1982 World Cup in Spain on the wall. It hadn't been filled out, but it was just groups, who plays who. He had it up on the wall. And that to me was like the internet. I couldn't stop looking at it. So just memories like that, if you were in Canada, that's how you picked the game up. I think a lot of people nowadays don't realize how good they have it in terms of access.
So unless your barber also had a poster of Canada's upcoming qualification schedule, how were you able to keep up with that?
I always kept a really close eye on Canada's qualification. They would usually end without qualifying. You followed it, and then you were disappointed. And then you followed it again, and then you were super disappointed. And on we went.
So, a lot happened for us to get to St. John's. And now, Canada's national team had the opportunity to change the narrative on that wet and rainy day in September of 85 against Honduras.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to St. John's, Newfoundland. Graham, Sam, and I are ready for what we hope will be Canadian sports history here this afternoon. Coming up next, the opening kickoff.
This was a colossal match. Bleachers were installed around the stadium to raise the capacity up to 13,000, and the setup meant fans were basically hovering over the pitch, allowing them to impact the game more than your typical small home crowd. It also helped that the majority of the Honduran fans had accidentally traveled to St. John, New Brunswick, and had to catch the game at a bar. I doubt they had Salva Vida on tap. The clogged pitch made it difficult to play fast patterns or dribble at speed. This benefited Canada. Honduras possessed more individual skill, but the conditions nullified it, allowing Canada to play their organized, scrappy, and opportunistic game. And in the 15th minute, they were rewarded off a corner kick.
Carl Valentine, take it. Swings it in, Bridge gets a head on it. There's the shot, they score!
And that's the goal that Canada needed.
Remember the part-time water meter reader who had scored the lone goal in Honduras? It was George Pagos who had stepped up again. Pagos had never appeared for Canada until the age of 31 and had been cut from the Canada squad after the first round of qualification. An injury had forced Tony Waiters to recall him. Pagos, who had vowed to never play for his country again after being cut, quickly abandoned that stance and flew to Honduras to meet up with the squad. His home-and-away goal scoring against Honduras stands as one of the most unlikely clutch performances in the history of Canadian sport. As the game wore on, Honduras began to adapt to the conditions and grab a foothold in the game. Right after halftime, they equalized.
Here's a chance now for Honduras. Chip back in through the middle. A shot! They score!
This was gut check time for Canada. and Igor Varablich, one of the squad's strongest players, would tip in a 61st-minute corner.
Swings it in, near post, headed away, and it's in! It's in!
Now knowing they just needed to keep Honduras from scoring twice, Canada loaded its own half, mostly clearing the ball once they got it. They literally parked the bus.
Touch as the Canadians continue to kill the clock. This is years of preparation coming to a climax.
Until finally, the full-time whistle blew.
Referee again checking his watch. And there it goes! The final whistle! Canada has qualified for World Cup 86, defeating Honduras by a score of 2-1 here in St. John's, Newfoundland this afternoon.
A great team effort by Canada, and they didn't sneak in on the back door. They beat the defending champions of CONCACAF 2-1 here in St. John's.
I was born in 1998. When I hear about Reagan's presidency, the Walter Payton Bears, and the release of The Princess Bride, my perception of that time is that it seems like an entirely different world to the one that I grew up in. To think that Canada qualified for the World Cup before I was even born is unimaginable to me, as if it happened in a different world. But Canada was going to the World Cup in under a year's time. And while the Canadian players would narrow their focus on St. John's that evening, it didn't stop Tony Waiters from ordering them to load the bus in the early morning. Commencing one of the most collectively hungover road trips of all time. Because so much of Canada's squad was made up of amateur players or players without regular high-level soccer, Tony Waiters decided to make the Canadian team travel to anywhere in the world that was willing to pay them to play them. They did a tour of South Africa, a tour of Asia, and they spent significant time in Colorado, hoping that becoming acclimated to the altitude would serve them well for Mexico. As the World Cup approached, Waiters began bringing some fresh faces into the fold, which included Colin Miller, a Scottish-born midfielder who'd moved to Vancouver as a child and played for the Toronto Blizzard of the NASL in 1982. As a young player surrounded by veterans, Miller was able to witness the intangibles that separated the Canada squad from the other teams he had played with.
We were such a hard-working group. Tony had instilled those standards in us right from centre-forward, whether it was Dale Mitchell or whether it was Ian Bridges as a centre-back with Andy Samuel. Those same principles applied to every single player. If you weren't at a certain level of fitness, if you didn't have the right attitude to come in and work for the team, then you wouldn't play. So we knew that. It was probably the most organised team that I ever played for. But Tony Waiters, you knew exactly what your role was. And you had to make sure that role was fulfilled. And there were no gray areas with Tony. You either do it the way you wanted him to do it, or definitely you would be sitting watching.
Eventually, Miller would be named to the 23-man World Cup squad. But a last-minute decision by Tony Waiters would leave him shocked.
It was basically Tony's decision that Canada selected 22, 23 players, whatever it was at that time, Henry. But he only wanted to take 18 players to Mexico. So I was one of the four players that was left here in Vancouver. It was just so frustrating. I said to Tony, I totally disagree with your decision. And Tony's arguments was that he felt the more players who were not playing, the more disharmony that would be in the group. And I said to him, I said, listen, if you're talking about Holland or France or Italy or some of these other major countries where there's a few egos floating about, then I could understand that. You could have a bit more of an argument. I said, but this is Canada. And I said, this is the first time we've been to the World Cup. I just totally disagreed with his decision. I said, but I'm ready to come in if ever there's an injury or anything like that. We all did.
Looking into Miller's eyes on our Zoom call, I could tell how difficult it was for him to relive that moment.
We were all desperate to play for our country and for sure desperate to go to the World Cup. So I actually get quite embarrassed when people ask me, they say, what was it like in Mexico in 86? I said, well, it was probably very warm and sunny. I said, but I couldn't tell you because I was sitting in Vancouver watching the games. So it was disappointing.
Tony Waiters had been through his own similar disappointment. Having been a successful goalkeeper in English soccer's first division while at the height of his career, he'd been named to the initial 1966 England World Cup squad. However, he was ultimately cut from the squad just before the tournament. And as host, England won its only ever World Cup. Waiters would retire shortly after to transition to coaching. In 1973, he led England's youth team to a European championship before winning Plymouth Argyle promotion from England's third division 2 years later. In 1977, while still at Plymouth, the Vancouver Whitecaps came calling. Waiters took the job and moved to Canada. He would lead the Whitecaps to an NASL title in 1979, defeating the heavily favored New York Cosmos. And in 1981, Waiters took over Canada, coming up 1 point shy of qualifying for the 1982 World Cup. With more time to prepare, Waiters instilled his organized approach into the squad, and it immediately paid dividends. At the 1984 Olympics, Canada took a strong Brazil side to a penalty shootout in the quarterfinals after leading the game up until the 70th minute. Nobody ever asked Waiters on the record if his personal experience with England shaped his rationale for leaving Canadian players home. But with an opening match against European champions France, Canada and Waiters would finally have the eyes of the soccer world on them.
That French team, and they never won a World Cup with that group of players, which is still one of the great crimes of all time. Platini and Jarres and the entire team, that arguably was the best team to never win a World Cup. Arguably.
The fans in Mexico had taken up the habit of holding up their fingers to predict what the final score of each match would be. For France versus Canada, they were using both of their hands to refer to France. They weren't alone in predicting a thrashing. Bookmakers had positioned Canada as an all-time underdog. Captain Bruce Wilson claims to have seen their odds of scoring against France listed at 300-1. Give me 10 bucks, and one Canadian goal turns that into 3,000. That's how improbable bookmakers deemed it. Now, in fairness, Canada was in the rare position of qualifying for the World Cup without having a fully functional domestic league back home. This had been one of FIFA's primary reasons for declining Canada's bid to host this very World Cup. Mexico had already hosted a World Cup just 16 years prior in 1970, and the FIFA president had admitted on the record that both Canada and the US had made more compelling pitches. In fact, Canada had submitted a 90-page proposal to FIFA, while Mexico had just submitted 10 pages. Needless to say, the Canadian Soccer Association felt it had been played. And while the Canadian players undoubtedly lacked experience when compared to a typical World Cup side, they weren't going to be totally starstruck by playing somebody like Michel Platini, who was the consensus best player in the world at the time. Many of the Canadians had played against Pelé in the NASL and even defeated him. As revered as Platini was, nobody was revered on a soccer pitch like Pelé. The game started, and it was Canada who was creating chances and putting their superior opponents under pressure.
And Rabich running onto the end of it. They were all standing watching him, the French. And back out of his goal, covered on the line. Still Valentine. Still over the place, the French.
Eventually, France got settled, and Canada's chances and time on the ball dried up. But the Canadians kept the French at bay from scoring. First halftime came, then the clock was ticking past the 60th minute, then the 70th minute. By now, France was repeatedly unlocking the Canadian defense, but their star striker, Jean-Pierre Papin, could not seem to find a finish.
He played for the first time against Northern Ireland. He gets his chance now because of injury. And really, he should have scored then. Platini, the provider, finding Amoros on the right, and it looked like a simple tap-in,
but it was anything but. Latini. Marvellous ball to Rosto. To Papa. He's made the move. Unbelievable. To be fair to him, it was no more than a coat of paint. What a marvellous pass by Platini in the first place, which I'm afraid we're not going to see, but Rosto gave the chance to Papin, made his angle, and actually was rather wiser than it seemed from Papin. No! Well, we're in a city from whence it's said that 90 million pairs of shoes are sold each year. Well, I can only suggest that Jean-Pierre Papin goes in search of a different pair of boots, because he's never going to score with these two today.
Honestly, when was the last time you heard a modern-day commentator shred a player like that?
Fine run by Betty Stone's got two in the middle. Papa! Well, I hate to tell it, but I told you so. Although the woodwork denied him that time. How unlucky can you get? And the gods are clearly on Canada's side. They want them to achieve what everybody thought would be impossible. Dolan struggling a bit here. And it's falling! Papa turns to claim it. But I'm not sure that it wasn't there already, but we can wait to see. Stopyra certainly thinks it was his. Papin is 17. Stopyra at the back. Well, no, it's certainly Papin's.
Finally, the French and Papin would break their drought and win the game 1-0. But Canada had won the sincere respect of their adversary. In the post-match interview, Michel Platini was asked, how is it your team only won 1-0?
On doit rendre hommage aux Canadiens. Ils ont bien joué. Cela a été difficile pour nous, mais nous sommes satisfaits d'avoir marqué un but.
That's the voice of my grandma and not Michel Platini. But I thought it was important you got to hear it in the beautiful language of French. What Platini said was, you have to give the Canadians credit. They played hard. It was difficult for us. We're happy to score that one goal.
To hang with that team for that long. Come on. Some people don't believe in moral victories. That's bullshit. And Canada played with them the whole time. It's still, to me, it's one of the great moments in Canadian soccer history. Their performance on that afternoon in France under a hot Mexican sun.
Canada had a newfound sense of belonging. Soon after, they learned that their next opponent, Hungary, had lost 6-0 at the hands of the Soviet Union. According to squad member Bob Lenarduzzi, the contrast of playing France tightly and seeing that the Hungarians had gotten battered briefly corrupted the attitude of the squad.
2-minute mark, it will be Esterhazy. As this cross bounces off David Norman, and there is Martin Esterhazy just inside the post. Wasn't much room there, but he beat Tino Lettieri, making his first World Cup start. And we see another look at him.
Against Hungary, Canada came out flat, conceding in just the second minute. This allowed the Hungarians to play conservatively and make Canada chase the game in the second half. Canada would lose 2-0. It wasn't a terrible result, but now something dangerous lingered in the air. The possibility of a goalless tournament.
I knew that the games would be very difficult to play. And now in hindsight, of course, I look back and I think that maybe we could have been a little bit more adventurous going forward.
Tony Waiters steadfastly believed that the best way to gain Canada credibility in the soccer world was to avoid the blowouts that everyone had predicted. He was never going to compromise Canada's defense. In Canada's final game against the Soviets, they carved out chances, but after going into halftime 0-0, they would lose 2-0. Still, Canada had played 3 bona fide soccer countries and kept all of them tight. Yet what should have been a feel-good story about an overachieving group almost tying France became about the failure of being unable to score.
Something I noticed growing up was that the first time I ever asked my dad if Canada had made a World Cup before, he started his answer with, yeah, but they didn't score. And I noticed that same exchange happening all the time. And more recently, my friends have been asking me if we ever made the World Cup in the past. And I've been defaulting to that same phrasing. And I hate it. I think it's incredible that group got there. They didn't have a domestic league. They didn't have infrastructure in place, the training that other countries had. Some of them weren't just professional soccer players. And I think the headline should be that they went 78 minutes versus France, not that they went goalless. And I was wondering if I could get your take on that. Yeah, but.
Yeah, but about the 86 team does bother me. That was one of the lazier arguments in Canada and North America, not just Canada, that you would ever hear is, where's the scoring? Where's the scoring in soccer? You run around, ties, where is it? Unless you grew up with soccer at that time, that was always the fight. Like, we grew up with soccer. My buddies grew up with soccer. My family grew up with soccer. When you would hear the shit that people would talk about the sport, who never watched, I mean never, yet knew every criticism, I don't know where they're getting it, but knew every criticism was infuriating. That really annoyed me back then. We fought a hard uphill battle against ignorance. A lot of people in this country, media
until
and otherwise.
Like 6 months ago.
Until a while ago, yes.
Canadians who had given soccer a chance for perhaps the first time in their life had seen their team go goalless and reacted harshly to it. Tony Waiters would retire at the end of the month, and 3 months after the World Cup ended, four prominent Canadian players were caught taking bribes from match-fixing bookmakers in Singapore. What should have been a year that served as a catalyst for Canadian soccer ended with an alarming lack of certainty for the future. After 86, when you're looking ahead to 1990, are you thinking, well, surely we're going to be able to get back there sooner rather than later?
That would have been a natural reaction, Henry. So it was really, really disappointing.
In Chapter 2, the next generation of Canadian players take center stage.
With a shot. Oh, what a great save by Craig Forrest.
The Canadian Soccer Association completely ignored me.
Leading to flashes of brilliance.
What a way to start the new decade.
In an era of defeat.
I knew when he made that decision, we were in trouble as a country for a bit. It was going to take a while to get over that.